It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
Where the pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself in a Christian worldview.
Welcome to Quantum number 5. Let's begin with some good news. From Argentina, where senators have voted 38-31 to reject proposed new laws on abortion. This has come as a bit of a surprise. One of the things that interests me here is the way that groups like Amnesty International took out a full-page advert in the New York Times. Just think about that just for a moment. Amnesty International, an international organization for human rights, take out an advert in an American newspaper to try to influence senators in Argentina, politicians in Argentina. I don't think anything indicates more to me the Western imperialism of Western liberalism than that. When they failed, they said that the Argentinian government had missed a historic opportunity to be leaders on human rights. Yeah, except for the human rights of the child. It was great to hear our friend Peter Williams of Right to Life speak up so well when he pointed out, dealt with two major arguments. One, the question of if women are doing this illegally and harming themselves, then surely it would be better to be done legally.
But the fact is, as you say, illegal abortions are still taking place in Argentina. Mm. I mean, some stats say it's as high as 500,000 each year, yeah. You know, between 350 and 500,000. Mm. So this is happening. I mean, shouldn't it be happening in a controlled, safe environment?
To which his response was excellent.
Well, an analogy might help with that. I mean, one of the things that we, of course, abhor in the modern world is the hurting of women by forced genital mutilation. Now, obviously that happens regardless of whether or not it's legal. But would we really say, if it could be made legal and therefore more sanitary, would it be therefore okay to legalize and say yes, because that will lead to fewer women being butchered in the worst way that they could be in illegal situations in Africa? Fewer women would die because of it. Would we really say that? Or would
but
we rather say that this is a matter of human rights?
But should,
this is
exactly,
a matter of the right of the girl not to be abused, and in the same way, it's the right of the unborn child not to be destroyed in her mother's womb. So that, I think, shows that argument simply doesn't work.
If female genital mutilation is being done illegally, why not make it legal so less harm is done? The argument is obvious. And talking about the right of the individual, what if there are two individuals involved?
But the argument that a lot of human rights groups are making is that this should be the choice of the individual.
Well, the choice of the individual extends only insofar as it doesn't hurt another individual. And in this case, we have two individual human beings. On the one hand, we have the mother. On the other hand, we have the unborn child. And a truly civilized society should want to love and care for both of them. That's why truly humane medical reforms that introduce the best kind of obstetric care for women, but do not destroy unborn children themselves, that's the best kind and most civilized kind of reforms that could really
be put forward. Since 1983, something like 3,000 women have died as a result of illegal abortions. I mean, again, shouldn't it go back to providing it in a safe environment for these women?
Well, that's again why I brought up FGM, because if it were true that we could decrease the number of women dying or girls dying due to FGM, would we really want to legalize a practice that involved an intrinsic abuse of the human rights of women? Of course we wouldn't want to do that. Well, in the same way then, why would we want to legalize a practice that denies the most fundamental right, which is the right to life of the unborn child? If we truly believe in human equality, we cannot believe in legalized abortion. What we should be instead in trying to engage in is a medical culture that supports mothers and babies equally.
Sadly, in Scotland, we have continued downwards, and the Society for the Protection of the Unborn Child, they have found that this week they lost their case against the Scottish government, who have permitted women to take pills for abortion at home without supervised medical care, which in terms of the 1967 Act is illegal. However, the judge decided that it wasn't. On this same subject, consider this from Hungary. And this is another good news story. Hungary has seen a drop in abortion numbers by more than a third. So in 2010, there were 40,449. And today, or last year, it was 28,500. Incidentally, there's also been a plunge in the number of divorces, and there's also been a surge in the number of marriages. Now, why is that? Part of it is because the government there has operated a very pro-family policy. And I do think that that is a key and significant factor. One more thing on this whole issue. We'll put a link on the blog to an amazing video I saw on Facebook of a child in the womb. I challenge anyone to watch that and to say, that is not a human being. He is not a human being. She is not a human being. Remember the slippery slope argument? Remember how people said, oh, don't be ridiculous, it'll never happen? Well, in Belgium, we have been told that euthanasia now means the euthanasia of children. Two children, aged 9 and 11, have become the world's youngest to be euthanized. They were given lethal injections in 2016 and 2017. The 9-year-old had a brain tumor and the 11-year-old had cystic fibrosis. Belgium has amended its euthanasia law in 2014 to make it legal for doctors to terminate the life of the child, however young, who makes the request. Now again, just consider what's going on here. In that law, it says that children must be judged to have the mental capacity to make the decision and receive parental consent. Okay. But then think about that in other ways. We have determined in a lot of Western society that children are able and have the mental capacity to determine what gender they are. They are able and have the capacity, apparently in Belgium, to determine whether they should die. But they are not able and do not have the mental capacity to determine whether they should engage in sexual relationships. Now, please don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating sexual relationships for children. What I'm saying is we are consistent as Christians saying that children do not have the mental capacity to do any of these things. But our society is inconsistent, allowing the ideology of the adults to overcome the rights of the child. Let's talk about fences. No, we're not going to talk about a massive fence along the Mexican-US border, and we're not going to talk about Brexit and Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. But let's talk about Denmark and Germany. Now, that's a border I have crossed several times. I remember hitchhiking there. And there's a proposal right now from the Danes that they're going to build a fence. The fence is going to be for wild boars because Denmark has a significant pig industry. 50% of its agricultural exports are to do with the pig industry, or pork, in effect. And wild boars bring swine flu. So they're going to build this fence to try and stop them. Although some are a bit suspicious because wild boars can swim and they can jump, and it's not considered that the fence would be that effective. So some are perceiving this as really being a fence to try and stop immigrants. Because what's happening in paradise in the Scandinavian countries is really quite significant. If you go across to Sweden, we'll come back to Denmark in a moment, but if you go across to Sweden, in Sweden, the far-right party, the Sweden Democrats, in the last opinion poll, they were considered to be number one in all age groups. Now, it would be astounding if they came second, unbelievable if they came first. And that's because what's going on in Sweden just now is tied in with immigration. There is gang warfare. There are lots of things that are happening in this most feminist of countries. Women are increasingly less safe. There was a story in the New York Times which was fascinating. A man called Paulos Borisho, age 55, who himself was a Lebanese refugee, saying that he felt it was no longer safe in Sweden. Somebody had been killed not too far from his shop with a hand grenade that they had picked up. Now, says this Lebanese refugee, when I think of the future, I am afraid. I am afraid for Europe. Perhaps nothing illustrates this more than the Øresund Bridge, which is just a wonder. It's a 10-mile bridge that links Malmo in to Denmark, in Malmo in Sweden to Denmark. When it opened in 2000, it was kind of symbolic of the new, vibrant, borderless Europe. Now it's become infamous as a bridge that's associated with smuggling of people, of weapons, and of drugs. Somehow it seems that Nirvana is no longer Nirvana. Thanks again for all the feedback from last week. And there was a great deal of feedback about Boris Johnson and his remarks. I think the thing that astounded me most, I did an interview on Premier Christian Radio, and I've done some other stuff as well, but we'll put a link to the Premier one. I think the thing that astounded me most, or amused me most, was the fact that Boris is probably going to be sent on a diversity training course, which really, I mean, how do you even begin to cope with that? That's the answer to everything. Re-educate people, send them out to make sure they have the correct opinions. Whatever happened to free speech and people thinking for themselves? I think what happens to Boris Johnson over the next few weeks will have a major impact on the future of this country. And please understand, I'm not saying this in defense of Mr. Johnson or of his views. I'm saying even if I find his views objectionable or you do, he still must have the right to express them. Otherwise, how can we deal with them? Take this, for example, from the Deputy Chief Inspector of the Metropolitan Police in an interview with Julia Hartley Brewer, where he seems to be suggesting that even to critique Islamic clothing would be a hate crime and illegal.
When you have individuals who make comments like this, there are bigots out there who won't be reasonable, who will think, well, this is an opportunity for me to go out. I mean, it's happened in the past. And I think the reality of the situation is, I think that there's two issues here. One is the issue about freedom of speech. I don't think anybody's suggesting, I've not heard anybody suggesting that you can't have a discussion about this. I think the key thing is that, you know, we make sure that you have the discussion in a reasonable manner. And when you start talking about women looking like, you know, bank robbers and
But they do. He wasn't saying they look like an animal or they look. He wasn't saying they look like the devil or anything. He was likening them to inanimate objects. And the whole point of the burqa and the niqab is to dehumanize, to de-individualize, depersonalize, and give a woman no identity. She's just a possession of a man, either her father or her husband. That's the whole point of the burqa.
That's a very unfair comment, because you've had 100 women write in who wear the niqab, yeah, who's basically saying, it's our right, it's our freedom to wear it.
Yeah, and it is under the law.
And basically, those individuals have said, we want to wear it. So I think this
is... So why is it unfair to me to say what I just said?
Julia, let me please finish. It's unfair, I think, to talk in a derogatory way about women if they make a decision to wear it.
No, I was talking about the garment. I'm allowed to make any comment I want about a garment. It's a free country.
Well, I think if women decide, if women say that they want to wear it, and they are legally allowed to do so,
as Boris Johnson, yeah, a point he was making. But are you telling me I'm not allowed to say that I think that garment is ugly, nasty, discriminatory, offensive? I'm allowed to say that. I live in a free country. I'm allowed to say that.
Another area of feedback comes from the ubiquitous pride marches that are occurring everywhere. So in England, in Ely Cathedral, there was a flag that was flown from the cathedral, and that's caused a great deal of fuss as it became a church that sponsored the Pride Parade. But also up here in Scotland,
a growing number in the church locally, nationally and internationally are coming to realise that as ministers and members of the church alike, you are who you are. You are who God has created you to be. You are loved by this Creator. You are a beautiful human being, and it is a travesty of justice that it should ever have been thought or said to be otherwise. Thank God the times, they are a-changing.
Scott Burton, a Church of Scotland minister, opened the Perth Pride Parade, and that's created a great deal of fuss, as any of you who read my blog will realise. What's interesting is how people have tried to intimidate us into silence, accusing us of hate speech and everything else. But we don't hate people. It's because we love people that we want to communicate what God says, because that's the best for us. And if you do have time, please do go and have a read of a post that I put on the blog from somebody who is same-sex attracted, who's found it really helpful, who says that the gospel we preach is far better than the gospel of accommodation that Vicky Beeching preaches. Go and have a look at that. And speaking of Vicky, she's continuing her campaign.
And my mission really is to just help people of faith, especially, to re-examine this issue, to realise the church has got things wrong in the past, and that we can revisit, you know, the Bible and church history, just look at it again and realise actually there isn't anything wrong with being gay and the church needs to change its teaching.
This week she was on Hard Talk, which for her became Soft Talk, and also on Lorraine on Monday morning on ITV. And again, pushing this agenda that the church is going to change and that the law should be involved and that any kind of conversion therapy should be banned. And she's also, of course, pushing herself as the victim and anyone who disagrees as being the oppressor. So it's kind of very much ongoing. Now, I came across this fascinating talk in, I think it was in Kansas, where she's addressing a pro-LGBT group from different churches. And again, what struck me, because it was really her testimony, was that in the whole of the talk, there was very little about Christ and a great deal about herself and about her two identities. One identity, clearly, was in her sexual orientation. But the other, and this still surprises me, was not her identity as a Christian, but her identity as a worship leader. She had her job. And again, I think that is part of the problem. And notice the supreme and absolute confidence that she has that there will come a time in the church, a tipping point, where all of a sudden we'll all change and we'll all say, just as we did with slavery, oh, we were always against it. We'll all say we're always for LGBT rights.
Now, we are at the front of this curve. We're ahead of it. And that can be a lonely place. We're on the cusp of a wave that's crashing in. We're pioneers. But know that there is a tipping point, and I believe that that's on the horizon. That the tipping point is a phrase within sociology. Many of you know it. And it refers to a point in time where a group rapidly and dramatically changes their behavior by adopting a previously rare practice. Malcolm Gladwell speaks of it as the moment of critical mass, the boiling point in the spread of new ideas and beliefs. It's the tipping point where suddenly it goes from being crazy to being sort of acceptable to being a lot of people like it to suddenly being, oh, of course everybody does that. And we've seen that happen with so many things in society, haven't we? From the abolition movement to the rights of women. And there will come a time in the church, even in the evangelical church, where suddenly everybody will go, of course we're LGBT inclusive. What do you mean? We never thought those things. And that will happen, and it's going to take a lot of grace from people like us to be like, okay. Just dust off all the omen of the end time stuff that you said to me last week. So that tipping point is ahead. There's conversations happening even now behind closed doors. Pastors of huge churches are getting ready to change their mind and speak out. And then on a grassroots level, there's hundreds of thousands of people that are reading books like Matthew's, and they're wrestling with ideas, and they're coming to the place where they can finally think about speaking up. And literally, I think it's going to be one day, it's just going to be like a touch paper, and suddenly this huge change is going to roll in.
Vicky does not understand how biblical Christianity works. We listen to Christ speaking in the scriptures. We do not follow what the culture says. That's why we were radical enough to challenge slavery, and that's why we're radical enough to challenge the oppressive theology of the LGBTQI queer theory propagandists who want to dismantle humanity, deconstruct humanity, and destroy the family.
In the distance, day was dawning. Comes to me the early morning. Something tells me that I'm going home.
This weekend is a sad weekend for those of us who like Scottish Gaelic rock music. Okay, there's not a lot of bands to choose from, but one of the greats, the absolute great, is of course Runrig.
Going home when the summer's coming in and the moonlight on the river shows me where I've been.
And it's their final concerts this weekend at Stirling Castle. I once interviewed Callum MacDonald for Murray Firth Radio, and I love the family emphasis that he spoke about the band as having and the Christian influence that they had had, which you can clearly hear in many of their songs. And the story he told me of how when they were on tour in Germany one time, that there was a hotel they were staying in where they had to send a message down to the lobby, which basically said, "Can you please be quiet? There's a rock band trying to get some sleep." If I had to pick one Runrig song that for me, it shows how music can be evocative of memories, it would be the song Going Home. Because when I was at the University of Edinburgh and I'd go back to the Highlands, I would always play this just before I went. And every time I hear it, it reminds me of those train journeys and those times at university. Our quote of the week comes from Chrysostom, who, when he's faced in Antioch with a situation which was as troublesome as it is now in Syria, says this. Forgive my voice, by the way. And before I read you this, please do feel free to send us feedback. There's been lots of feedback over the past week, and I really do appreciate it, and we really do take it on board. Chrysostom says this. Remember, he's facing war and death and everything else. What then, I pray you, is death? Just what it is to put off a garment. For the body is around the soul like a garment, and after laying this aside by means of death for a short time, we shall resume it again with more splendor. What is death at most? It is a journey for a season, a sleep longer than usual. So that if you fear death, you should fear sleep. If you are grieved for those who are dying, grieve also for those who are eating and drinking. For as this is natural, so is that. Don't let natural things sadden you. Rather, let those things which come from an evil choice make you sorrowful. Don't sorrow for the dying man, but rather sorrow for him who lives in sin. Amen. God bless you. See you next week.
We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they get attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge and oddly enough, but makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christians living like aliens trying to relate with citizens of a different nation. What always makes for a better presentation than bark and bite is a proper understanding of living life filled with salt and light. So we walk this fine line of walking in light of God's kindness and live with a sense of worldliness without the fear of compromising. Loving God and neighbor until Christ comes to split the sky or die in a society hailing Jesus as Messiah. Yep.